It is.
The House Workforce Development Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. This morning, we have two presentations, one from the department and one from Dr. Corey. But before we do that, I'm going to have the COA take roll.
Okay. Representative Zhang.
Here.
Representative Brand. Representative Baker.
Aye.
Representative Becker Finn. Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Hassan. Representative Hemmingson Yeager.
Here.
Representative Ryer.
Here.
Representative Sensamura.
Here.
Representative Harder. Representative Nelson?
Present.
Representative Weens?
Here.
Representative Zelenskar?
Here.
Okay. All right. We have a quorum. Last week we did some introductions. I know that we forgot to introduce some other staff and members, and Representative Cedric Frazier was in committee presenting the bill. So if you could introduce yourself to our colleagues, sir, Representative Frazier.
What do you want me to talk about, Chair?
Everything. Everything.
Come on. You got the floor. The
mic is like slinking. You got plenty of time here.
All right, here we go. Representative Cedric Frazier, District 43A, which is in the northwest suburbs, the cities of Crystal and New Hope. This is my second term, and I'm vice chair of the Judiciary Committee, and my chair is walking in right on time. How about that? We timed that out perfectly. Good to be here, everybody.
Thank you, Representative Fazer. And we have a new page who's working with us here, so if you could introduce yourself, stand up and say your name.
Thank you. My name is Zach Cullen. This is my first year here as a committee page. I just graduated from North Dakota State University, and I'm very excited to work with you all. Thank you.
All right.
Welcome,
Zach. Sir.
Jackrabbit?
All right. Moving on. With, if I could have Chair Becker Fenn move the minutes from January 11th, 2023.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. First on the agenda is...
We can submit the motion. We got to vote.
Oh, what?
To approve the minutes.
Chair Becker Finn moves to approve the minutes. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Okay. Motion prevailed. All right. Our first presentation is building a world-class Alana BIPOC workforce in Minnesota from Dr. Bruce Corey. So, Dr. Corey, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Zhang, Vice Chair Brand, Representative Baker, and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to share some insights on building a world-class Alana workforce in Minnesota. I'm Dr. Bruce Corey, Professor of Economics and a founding member of the Alana Brain Trust. Alana stands for African American, African Immigrant, Latino, Asian, and Native American communities. This week, we remember the rich legacy of Dr. King. He visited India in 1959 to learn about Gandhi's strategy of nonviolence. And while there, he was invited to the southern state of Kerala. You see, Kerala is well known for the Kerala paradox. The poorest of the poor have the highest literacy rates and health outcomes, unlike in other parts of India and the world. Dr. King was possibly invited to visit and experience this miracle. People were awakened about their rights and responsibilities to change their own destinies that had the positive impact on education and health. That experience had such a deep impact on him that he reflected on it for 6 years. My doctoral research focused on the Kerala paradox, and my conclusion was that we need a holistic approach to economic development. The same youth that was mobilized to change his or her destiny in Kerala and got a master's degree became a frustrated, unemployed youth with many committing suicide. We need wealth building to complement social and political mobilization, and we also need spiritual healing. Over the last 25 years in Minnesota, I've been wrestling with the Minnesota paradox as called by Dr. Samuel Myers of the Humphrey Institute, the presence of high income with high racial disparities. I've been blessed by being involved with the governor's working group on minority business development in 2000 to the governor's workforce development council, leading economic development at the city of St. Paul, and my involvement with the Atlanta Brain Trust and other groups. This reflection on workforce also draws inspiration from the work of my wife, a practitioner in this world, from people I engage on a daily basis looking for a loan or a job or a worker, and the insights of a young man I met in the 1990s, who a son of Rondo, who works on the front line but also reflects on the conditions of his existence, asking the questions such as, why do the poor pay more for everything? A paradox in itself. I'm sharing this, my reflection now on these five critical questions. Why now, how, at what cost, and how do we assess outcomes? Let me begin with the first question, why? I was one of the Cory plaintiffs who, for the first time in Minnesota history, were at the table when the current boundaries of political power were framed. We asked the judges who will represent the $1.4 trillion Alana economy in Minnesota. Our map will show you how. The judges received our input and documented that input in the final order, where they also asked the legislature to listen to the voices of the Alana communities. Today, I make the case for the political representation of these economic interests, and if the Alana economic interests are not being adequately represented, then I guess it's time to go back to the judges to fix this. What you're doing here is very important. You are defining the contours of economic power through zoning, licenses, rules, and regulations. The foundational bedrock of racism is the denial of the value of a human being. Denied of value, the human being becomes a tool, an animal, an object that builds the wealth of those that control the economic prison. For three decades, I've shown that the emperor has no clothes. The Alana people have great value. I estimate it to be over $1.4 trillion, which is bigger and almost as great as the economy of Mexico. I also estimate that the economic cost of racism is at least $280 billion. The loss imposed on the Alana wealth building by those that constructed the economic prison, which I will share with you a little in the next slide. However, this number does not capture the mental cost because the denial of value was aimed at breaking the mind to view one less than what we are. That is why I was inspired when my wife recently accepted the stewardship of Twin Cities Rise. There, every participant is encouraged to realize a core part of their identity. I am loved, I am valuable, I am important, I am empowered. This insight is what Dr. King wrestled for 6 years in his mind when he spoke in Dexter Baptist Church. He named the beast and called for his transformation. The Minnesota has a sordid history with racial discrimination. But it is also a historic and a legal fact, and I'm putting it up to you here, and it's reflected in these racial covenants embedded in real estate documents and in redlining. Thanks to the work of people before me, our African American and Native American and other civil rights reader, the house, I can live in the house I currently live in the Como Park area, because on the map I saw it had those racial covenants on it. The Alana people were confined to this economic prison, as you can see on this map. And this stifled their abilities to build wealth, especially intergenerational wealth. Today, Professor Raj Shetty of Harvard, using big data, shows how the impact of these economic prisons have on our ability to achieve economic and social mobility, and point to two strategies, those of improving opportunities and those of building place. In this policy conversation also, there are two arguments. The first argument that lacks a historic context, and it says that the issue of the day that I'm referring to can be addressed through current programs. The I wish the same people or their ancestors were around when they were building the economic prisons and the subsequent launch of universal programs that could not be accessed by the Alana communities. I know this for a fact because I led the Department of Economic Planning and Economic Development for the city of St. Paul, this capital city, and saw that the prime resources of the city were accessed by primarily by those who walked the skyway in suits. Yes, we need to reshape these universal programs to be accessible to all, but we also need to correct the underinvestment and disinvestment in the Alana communities with specific community-focused investment. The other elephant in the room is that investing in with a specific focus on Alana workers is a zero-proposition. One party wins and the other party loses. This myth has no basis in fact. I present the results of an economic simulation, for example, to show that Alana workers produce about $200 billion of goods and services in Minnesota, and they support about 1 million jobs and help generate about $24 billion in taxes. I also document the many economic contributions that they make, and in the last legislative session, I showed through an economic simulation, for example, that if you invest in the African-American community, there's not enough African-Americans to do the kinds of work that the investments are calling for, and it's going to benefit all of Minnesota. So now we move to the question on why now, and what, as the famous saying going, saying goes, if not us, who, and if not now, when. We are in a distinct point of history where we have a huge budget surplus that can be shaped to make progress on undoing the harm of the past and build the foundations of the future. And remember, Alana communities have paid into this surplus, and I have data to show you that too. So let me provide some context of the powerful role that Alana workers play in Minnesota. There are more than 500,000 Alana workers in Minnesota working across all sectors of the economy, as you can see in this chart. And if you look at the top five sectors, administrative and support, waste management, healthcare, accommodation, manufacturing, agriculture, forestry, and fishing. And there are 54 industry subsectors where the Alana workers make up more than 25% of the workforce. And in adding some slides, because this is some data that's available, and if you don't see some information, is this kind of information, unfortunately, in a sense, is not easy to grasp. But when you look, for example, at the Hmong workers and the Mexican-American workers that I'll show you, there's a lot of shifts happening over time between sectors, and the question is, does our policy environment know that shift? Why is there a decline, for example, from manufacturing to educational and health services? But there's another point to be made here, and Chair Zhang would know this because in the 90s, I remember there would be these recruiters going to Hmong organizations like Lao Family Community and Hmong Mutual Association and HAP, and they would take not just one individual, they would take whole families to places like War Road to work there. But the question arises is, did we look after those workers and those families when they went there? Did we invest in schools for those kids? Did we invest in housing for those kids? Did those workers have an opportunity for social mobilization, career mobility in those companies? I'm not surprised at the shift from manufacturing to other sectors in this context. If you also look at the Mexican-American worker, this is also, you see the shifts that are happening in over time. But one of the historical facts is that we went out and recruited these workers from all across the U.S. and including Mexico to come and work here. And when we brought them here, we didn't treat them well. We used them to grow our beet, then we threw them on the street. That's literally what happened. After the summer planting season, They all had to live on their own, and many of them would live in St. Paul, and that's why you have the areas around St. Paul with the historical experience. So these point to the reason for more investment. If you look at the need for cultural intelligence and this table from Deed showing where black or African-American workers are found in 2020 and the top sectors, and the question is, what do we know and what are we doing for these workers in these, for personal care aides? And I have a friend who's a nurse, and the amount of time that she works over the week is really incredible, with no time for personal care. But what about investing in their presence? And what's happening in rural Minnesota is there a growing presence of Alana workers all across rural Minnesota. This is probably a surprising statistic. You would think that in terms of percentage of the workforce, the highest percentage of Alana people would be in the metro area. No, it's in Worthington. And then you have Albert Lea and Rochester and Fargo and Red Wing and Bemidji and Grand Forks and Fairmont and Fergus Falls, Winona and Brainerd and Alexandria. So this worker presence, this presence of the workers all across Minnesota. And Deed has some interesting statistics where you can look by planning region, and you'll notice that the composition of the Alana workers changes by region. For instance, in central Minnesota, the top three sectors are different from northeast Minnesota. But also when you look at the composition of workers, they are changing. And in, for instance, northeast Minnesota, you can see the important role that Native American workers play in different sectors of the economy. And I wonder which program or who is working to build the skills of those workers, Native American workers, in areas of northeast Minnesota and northwest Minnesota. And so when you look by southeast and southwest Minnesota, you look at the point is that cultural intelligence is needed, as even within a sector, there are different composition of Alana groups that require a different strategy to make their work more effective. And so each region would need a unique workforce strategy as even the stop sectors change. The other fact of life is that we have a graying population in Minnesota. And so this chart, again, from data from Deed, show the blue are people 55 years and older, the brown are the Alana percentage of the workforce. And you can see why this has become is an important sector, important aspect for Minnesota to consider. While the population is graying, the population of Alana communities are a younger group, so they are increasingly going to be that critical workforce in Minnesota. And these are the sectors that need policy attention, because the graying of the workforce is greater than 25% of the population, of the workforce. Transportation, real estate, wholesale trade, manufacturing, utilities, mining, agriculture. Then we also look at another prism around female workers, and the fact of life is that Minnesota is now a female-centric, and has been a female-centric workforce, and are our policy and programs attuned to that? Female workers greater than 50% of the workforce are found in healthcare, education, other services, finance and insurance, accommodation and food services, management, arts and recreation. But even here, when you look at the difference between Alana female workers and white female workers, you find a huge disparity. Say, for instance, the ratio of women's to men to white men's earning is 80% for white female workers, but only 53% for Hispanic, 59% for blacks, 71% for Asian, 59% for Native Americans, and 70% for multiracial. So again, we've got to look at the lens of how these programs are meeting the needs of our various demographics. So the key question then arises is, how should we address this issue? And I make the case that let's create a world-class Alana workforce in Minnesota. And below is and what would it cost? And below is some is a strategy and a concept. So The world, what do you mean by a world-class Alana workforce is that you have programs that focus on credentials and building up credentials and degrees and skills. You have career mobility within the workplace and workplace inclusion, because when you ask people on the street about their working conditions, one of the biggest things that pushes people off from the workplace is they're not respected. They're not invested in their workplace. We need career and sector pathways, as you've seen in the demographic changes that are happening all across Minnesota. And we need to build the pipeline to the future, the internships and apprenticeships. And as you could see in the slides before us, we need to operate with cultural intelligence. And so these are elements of what this Alana Workforce Fund would look like. It would have the worker at the center of the workforce programs. Currently, my sense is that it's not the worker that's the center of workforce program. It's the bureaucrat. It's the rules and regulations. It's the funders. It's something other than the worker. So we've got to reorient the system to make it the worker as the center of and what works best for this worker, and especially the Alana worker. We need to build these career pathways, as I mentioned, and apprenticeships and capacity building and cultural intelligence. And we also have to have funding with strong accountability, evaluation, and reporting systems, but with a minimum of bureaucracy. And this system should allow creativity and innovation and both public, private, and nonprofit. So this fund that would support these initiatives would be would have certain principles, and that is, can it leverage other resources? And a lot of DEED programs are looking at that leverage and documenting that leverage. Can it be accessible to all participants and providers? So how easy it is to engage with the system. I remember a professor friend of mine who applied for this grant for a partnership with a leading company, and she was all enthusiastic. We did the degree at Concordia, we launched it. But one day in the weekend, I saw what she was going through. She took me to the room, and she was by herself, and she was administering the grant by herself. There was a plethora of papers on her desk, and she was scratching her head of, how am I going to fill this paperwork? But that's what the system is doing to people who are trying to train people to work. And so can it be accessible? Can it focus on outcomes? Because ultimately, you want to see that the outcomes are there. Is it culturally intelligent, and is it flexible? And so I would suggest the strategy is that this session, the legislature allocates the funds, this $200 million, and then appoint a technical consultant to develop fund operations and participation, bring it to the public for input, and then January 1st thing, adopt and launch the fund. This way we'll develop a very good product. And so how do we come up with $200 million? I looked at the average cost per employee that DEED offers on its reports, and based on meeting, say, at least 50% of the current Alana population of about 500,000, I came up with that number of $200 million. So how will we address outcomes? There would be an Alana workforce fund board, and they will assess outcomes relative to the core fund principles of leverage, access, outcomes, goals, cultural intelligence, and flexibility. And for example, this is a simple radar graph and evaluation tool. And as you notice in this tool, I've not only added the principles of the fund, but also the people that may not necessarily reach the fund. And so if we have an intentional look to see, is it meeting the Alana single mother with kids? Is it meeting the immigrant and refugee? Is it meeting the Alana second chance hire candidate? Is it meeting the Alana college grad? Is it meeting our youth? And by constantly evaluating this framework, we'll be able to come up with a best program. So these are some thoughts I want to share with you, and I look forward to engaging in conversation today and any other time on the important role and the need to build a world-class Alana workforce in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. Do we have any comments or questions from members? Chair Becker Flynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Corey. It's always good to hear from you and hear what you're working on. One thing I just wanted to bring up that we heard testimony about yesterday in actually the Education Policy Committee in our discussion around Indigenous Peoples Day, but sort of to tie back so folks are really grounded in the history and why some of these disparities and some of these things exist. You know, we had government policies to take Native folks off of their land and move them to urban areas, and then the same examples you spoke of as far as then we didn't support them. We gave them the bus ticket and said, oh, there's great opportunities in Minneapolis. And that was kind of it. And at the same time, they were leaving their land, and then other folks were getting that land at a discount and taking it out of, you know, the tribal trust status, or it was being purchased by folks who had access to wealth. And so I just wanted to tie that together and also talk about housing and transportation and how if there are ways within this construct, you know, because what I see in so I own a coffee shop, and so I, you know, it's in that service, food service sector. And what I see is folks struggling, if they don't have wealth already, their access to transportation to get to work, their access to housing. You know, most of us, if you have the means, you choose housing that's close to where you work. With the, it's, you know, exception of my colleagues from rural Minnesota, but, you know, if the only housing you have access to is in Minneapolis and you have this good job in Roseville, that's really, really hard. And then you don't have access to transportation, you know, so it's sort of all the things that we do in all these, just giving people the skills and the training, and even good wages alone aren't enough if we're not also building in these other supports, remembering that people don't already have access to wealth. So I just curious on your thoughts on how this ties in with housing and transportation and those other things as well.
Dr. Curry.
Chair Zhang and Chair Beckerfin. Yeah, some of my inspiration derives from having sipping a nice cup of Mukwa coffee and and thinking about it. But whatever you just said is reflected in all that I'm talking about. Because you're speaking from cultural intelligence. You're speaking from boots on the ground. And those things allow you to see where the system is not working and what needs to be done. That spirit needs to be infused in our workforce system, because we are too used to sitting behind a desk and sending up emails or notices and not seeing what really happens. And when you actually, as a policymaker, because I know I did it myself when I was chair and director of planning and economic development, I would go to the neighborhood shop and talk to people, and I would find things I would never know before. So we need to infuse our strategies with the spirit and with the intent that you talked about. And also, thanks for lifting up that, again, a very gruesome experience of our youth and what they have to Native American youth that going up and having to do it. And I saw some of these same experiences in New Zealand and in Canada, where people talked about this system that was very harsh, cruel.
All right, well, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Dr. Corey. It is always a pleasure to hear your research and hear you talk about ways that we can address the issues that we face. You know, I look at this, and when you look at the data, we look at our school districts and we see how diverse our school districts are, and it clearly points us into the direction of what our future is going to look like in this state. And if we don't put policies in place similar to what you're suggesting here, we will not be able to enjoy the state of Minnesota. We will not have the resources or the privileges that we have now that everyone so much enjoys, our parks, our lakes. You know, our transportation and resources that we have, that will not still be the same if we don't invest the way we need to moving forward. And so with that question said, are there any other states that are focusing in this type of way with this type of program that you're suggesting that we do?
Dr. Curry.
Chair Chong, I'm not fully immersed in what is going on in other states. When I look at, say, for instance, the Markle Foundation, they bring out a lot of national reports, and I see some of these themes around pathways and within sectors. So I think that is there. I also want to lift up your comment about the next generation in the pool. There are about 500,000 Alana youth in the school and university system. And if I were to put a number on them, they estimate $1.5 billion portfolio of lifetime earnings if all of them get a bachelor's degree. And if we're not there, Minnesota's losing. And so how do we create that world-class educational system where our youth feel respected? Because they are going through systems, and some of them, when they get to high school, they're leaving town by saying, not anymore, I don't want to deal with what I went through in my school system. We need that talent to come back by creating an environment that works for all. We need to invest in quality, world-class educational system, but also within the learning system, a culturally intelligent learning environment. So that is the needs the policy attention of the legislature too. And at the last session, I testified to both the House committees to on a framework in which can build this in the future.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Corey, for that response. You know, I asked a question as to whether or not any other states are doing this, because what I like to point out is likely if we put this in place, we will be leading. We will be the model. And I like to lead, I like to be the model, and I like to show the country, rest of the country, how you can do things in a successful way and create success not only for the next couple of generations, for even longer than that. You know, one of the things I like what you had in your presentation was about having the ability to adapt. And I think what has happened in our state for a long time is, you know, I think about the Minnesota Miracle when it was put in place and what where the focus was there. I think what was not built into that was the ability to adapt and pivot and transition to what we have now, which is why we still continue to have some disparities we have. So this is less of a question and more of a statement. I think this is something that could really be beneficial to the state of Minnesota long term. So thank you for putting it together.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Corey. I appreciate your comments, as always. And I just want to make the observation that one of the things I particularly like about this is that it goes beyond intention, and wouldn't it be nice, and here are things we need to know, to saying we need to make investments. We can't have good outcomes if we don't make the effort to say, here we're going to put some money behind this. We need to invest in our communities. Representing Eagan and Burnsville as I do, people often have the illusion that I represent a non-diverse community, and that couldn't be farther from the truth. We're growing to our advantage all the time in terms of the people who are attracted to live in my area. So I want to thank you for that. And I have two questions. One, when I looked at the page about some of the specifics, and I don't have it in front of me, it struck me that we may have programs in education, we may have programs in workforce, labor, other places, but they're scattered, it's not a coherent whole. To what extent do you see this as pulling together some existing programs and threads, and how much would you say is completely new?
Dr. Corey.
Chair Zhang, Representative Freya, thank you for that question. Yeah, when I was in the Governor's Workforce Development Council many years ago, I was kind of overwhelmed with the plethora of programs, and so the question is, how do we, is there a need for integration of these different elements? And I think it's right, and that's what I in the suggestion about this plan of a fund, a $200 million fund, to first allocate it, but then to get some technical expert that will look at these questions of how will this fund operate and how will it encourage this integration around programs, and that may lead to greater integration. And in Chair Hassan's committee later, I'm going to talk about a model where maybe in communities there could be a community center that can help integrate the resources that come from different angles, so someone knows that these resources are available. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Ryer.
Yeah, thank you. It does. And my second question has to do with the evaluation page, which is 33. As a data person, I looked at that and just wondered if this is an accurate representation of where we are on each of these, or if it's illustrative.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Zhang, representative. You're right. It's just an illustration, and so it's not meant to be. That would be. I was just giving an example how you might have a goal and you might observe what is there, and that way you know, kind of like a compass where.
And it would probably be a longer conversation. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Probably be a longer conversation to say, where would you see us being, and you know, just more digging into the state of affairs. And I'll just leave that for another time. And just thank you very much.
Next is Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Corey. I appreciate your presentation. I've spent my life in healthcare, so the workforce is very critical for the whole state. And I think there's a couple points that I think is really critical that you made, that denial of value as a human being affects everybody, the whole human race, and I've seen that. And respect is critical. So I see this appointing technical consultants and wondered your feedback on that, on how you see the role of, you know, the city, the city, the schools, the trades. You know, we have 4-year pathways, and while I took that, I see many people I've employed do not want that route. They feel like a failure because that's not their what they want to do, or for many, many reasons. In all sectors, I've seen this, female, male. And so they get discouraged when they believe that is tied to only success. I wondered your sense in your study, too, of how we can support technical education, the 1-year programs, the 2-year programs. LPNs can become an LPN in 1 year. CNA classes in the high schools, middle schools, getting them exposed to intergenerational program early. We have Kiwanis. We have Rotary. I've been involved in those churches, the city, the community centers, the cultural diversity programs that exist, how we bring that all together in the fabric of a community to really have good educational pathways for all children. Because I think there's a gap, and I wondered your sense on that. And, you know, I really feel that parenting, when we're looking at respect, has got to be part of our education too. It's the hardest thing you do. It's been the most rewarding job I've had in my life, but we need education on strategies to understand it before we're parents, and not all people maybe have an opportunity for that. And so I wondered on parenting and also the whole piece of pathways for children in educational platforms beyond 4-year degrees. Thank you.
Dr. Corey.
Yes, Sean, Representative, thank you for that, the thought on the importance, first of the profession in healthcare. I believe it's 77% female-centric too, but I haven't seen policy and programs in healthcare that has acknowledged that and integrated that. About the question on the school system and the role of the hands-on, I think it's part of the way a fault of our existing educational system of not integrating the practical with the intellectual. And the role of career counselors and career departments within school systems that can help people bring these apprenticeship opportunities or internship opportunities, or have that garage on the campus where mm-hmm. people play around with it. We are not structured that way. And we need to restructure to bring in those practical components, because I believe other countries do it better, like maybe Germany, that's well talked about, and how they do it. If I had to redo my education, I'd really wish I'd know. I had a class how to fix a car and how to fix my.
Agreed.
Instead of going to YouTube University every time and checking it out, I would have to pay. So, but the value of these professions are also And in some ways, I think there's a way to inspire students through 3D printing, where they can see their idea printed and then learn how to take pieces together and put it together and how people are building houses out of it and trying to understand. So that inspiration can come into our system. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
I just want to say I like your question. The high school I attended in Chicago, it integrated all of that into it. I mean, I still have friends now. They're plumbers. They work in sheet metal. They work in a mechanic. Some own cosmetology shops because we integrated those types of activities and those types of training into our general program. When I say, and we use the term vocational, I remember when I first got to Minnesota and I worked in education, I brought up vocational. Got dirty looks, almost got kicked out of the room.
Mm-hmm.
But that was something that I remember that was very helpful to folks that I grew up with and my peers that I graduated high school from. And I thought that is something that should be always integrated, because when we talk about, one of the things you talked about in your presentation was where a line of folks are, and you, Worthington being a big population. Years ago when I was in graduate school, I was in urban planning program, and I remember meeting with a small town mayor. And their concern was, my town's going to die because people are leaving. We've seen a revitalization in most cases from our immigrant workers going to these communities and staying, and they're filling roles that would have been left open but not for them coming into those places. And we need that training, because that training will provide them with the skills that they need to fill roles that are being left open, particularly by the grain of our folks right now. So good question. And I think this captures, with the technical support, of how we can incorporate all of those things.
Dr. Quirk?
Chair Zhang, Representative Fraser, I wanted to lift up the slides showing the composition of the Atlanta workforce by region. And to your point, who's serving those workers? Do they even know that there's this opportunity to improve their skills?
Right.
Some of it, when you look at those pictures, you can see some dramatic numbers around two major groups, and that would be Latino and Black or African American workers all across Minnesota. And then if you look further, dig into the data, you can look at their skills and what percentage of them have less than high school education versus graduate education. When you look at that compared to income, you'll find that those communities will have a greater, higher skill, that also having higher income. So how do you make that transition, that career ladder that will take them from that low income level to that higher income level, and how do you build those particular professions to make it meaningful for people to work in them?
Okay. Representative Zalesnikar, saw you had your hand up.
Thank you, Chair. And Dr. Corey, I found it interesting on page 14 and 15 that the two areas to decline are manufacturing. So I just really hope that when we're looking at policy, we're looking at the role of the trades and partnering with trades. We won't be building houses. We won't have housing if we don't have people that know how to build a house. It's fundamental. And that respect to a child, his confidence and success in society for the entire human race is paramount. Kids learn many ways. I grew up with an educator, and to have a sense of confidence instilled in them when they find their path, and kudos to all of us that have the 4-year degree, and kudos to the ones that have the 2-year degree or the 1-year degree. I have both, 2 sons, 2 pathways. And I think we really have missed some opportunities within our communities to build that bridge in a successful way through education, through the business communities that exist in our communities, and to really do common sense training to allow children hands-on learning and to modify how we learn and to give them some opportunities. When you see success, your potential just blossoms. And so I want to see children see success sooner. And so thank you for your presentation.
Dr. Kaur.
Chair Zhang, Representative, I'm glad you focused on manufacturing, because when I look at the chart on page 23, the older workers, more than 25% are in manufacturing.
50%. And as a follow-up, I'd say we're losing that knowledge if we don't integrate them. Yes, thank you, Chair.
And so that all the more reason why we need to have that laser focus on manufacturing and what kind of manufacturing of the future and how do we train people.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. Well, members, I hope that this presentation was will help guide us and frame our work as we move forward to address our workforce. Up next is our commissioner from DEED. I want to give ample time for DEED to present today, too. And so thank you, Dr. Corey.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Zhang and members of the committees. And I also noticed that Deputy Commissioner Mark Majors is here, and he has influenced my thinking, too. So.
All right, that's great. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Well, thank you, Chair Zhang, members of the committee. My name is Steve Grove, and I'm the commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Joined by my colleagues today, Deputy Commissioner Mark Majors and Deputy Commissioner Evan Rowe. Thank you for having us. We are thrilled to be here today. And let me just start by congratulating all of you on your victories last fall, on your hard work to represent your state and your public service. We know these are incredibly difficult jobs and incredibly important jobs. And we are thrilled you're on one of the most important committees that your caucuses will be navigating in the coming months. Workforce development is on everyone's minds, as has already been shared here today. It touches almost every other issue in government right now. And so we are honored to be here today, honored to follow Bruce Corey, a great economist and a friend of the agency who's given us a lot of good advice over the years. And really kind of sets the stage for us to have the opportunity to give you a bit of an overview of what DEED does. That's the purpose of today's conversation. We can talk about a lot of the strategies that we're going to employ on workforce alongside all of you and leaders in the community. But today is about just kind of giving you a sense for what DEED does when it relates to workforce. Let me start just by introducing myself, because I know many of you and have worked deeply with a lot of you over the last 4 years in this job. But some of you I haven't had the chance to meet before. So let me give you a bit of a sense of who I am and where I come from and why I think this work is so important. I grew up in Northfield, Minnesota, about an hour south of here. My father had a small landscaping business, went to school in Northfield, working for my dad in the summers in his business, and then went to college out in California, at Claremont McKenna College, graduated, spent a couple of years abroad in Asia, teaching and volunteering, and then came back and began a career as a journalist in my mid-20s, starting in my hometown with the Northfield News and ultimately out east, the Boston Globe and at the Atlantic, and then made a shift kind of in my late 20s to technology. And after a stint getting a degree at the Kennedy School of Government, headed into YouTube in kind of the early days of when YouTube was a new platform being used to get information out into the world in ways that were at that time completely different from the ways in which media and politics had happened. There was an infamous moment, if you remember, in the 2006 midterm elections when a senator named George Allen of Virginia was caught on camera making a flub that sunk his election because YouTube spread that viral clip around the internet, and it kind of opened the world's eyes to the fact that the internet was going to change politics and media. So I came out as YouTube's first head of news and politics. It was early days. We built kind of a new effort around that. Ended up spending 12 years total at Google. Went from YouTube onto the illustrious Google Plus platform, the world's hottest social network. I'm sure you all use it every day. Actually, it doesn't even exist anymore, but it was a fantastic and interesting effort to try to get a social network off the ground from a company like Google, and boy, you learn a lot when you fail, don't you? So it was a really good chapter for me to just learn there, even though it was challenging. And then I spent my last few years at Google building a team called the News Lab, focused on innovation and media at a time when journalism, we know, is so challenged around the world, and Google has played a role in disrupting a lot of the traditional revenue sources that media organizations got. I built the team that I pitched into the company and was able to build a $300 million budget around to essentially help Google augment newsrooms' growth through data, through partnerships, through funding. So kind of a unique journey in technology. My wife and I met at Google, had twins, which we're very grateful for, and realized, wow, living in Silicon Valley with two little ones, where we have a family of folks back in Minnesota to be around is challenging. And we kind of thought, man, it'd be fun to come back to Minnesota. She's actually from San Diego, so it was a bit of a conversation around moving to a cold state like this. But we did it, and we moved here about 4 or 5 years ago. I was still with Google at the time, and then when the governor ran and won, I had known him from before. We began talking about how he was building his team. And the opportunity to come here and work at a department like this to grow our economy was really inspiring to me. I had started a nonprofit about 10 years ago called Silicon North Stars, focused on helping underserved youth find careers in technology, primarily North Minneapolis and East St. Paul. And we've been taking groups of these students out to Silicon Valley again and again over several years to give them a one-week technology camp at Google, Facebook. We'd bring them to different companies, give them exposure to the industry. Almost all students of color, all of them below the poverty line, about 15, 20 students a year. And then we'd put them through a startup competition to create their own companies. And it was just an effort to really kind of reset the dynamic in the technology industry, because it is heavily challenged from a diversity standpoint. And many of these students just didn't have exposure to these kinds of careers and opportunities. So it had kind of that Minnesota connection. It was focused on workforce development, on shifting the dynamics in our economy in an important way, and helping those that have barriers that really shouldn't be there. And that's just kind of my personal passion. It's where I came to this work from. It's why I was so excited to join this agency, because DEED uniquely covers both workforce development and economic development. So we're the only state that has kind of both of those worlds within one department. It's a huge advantage. It's a unique kind of secret sauce of how Minnesota operates. And it's why today you'll hear us walk through workforce, because that's this committee's focus. But we're also, of course, with Chair Asano over in economic development, focused on growing the economy as well. So these are kind of part and parcel of our strategy as an administration, as a state government over time. And I think today what we want to do is just walk you through the workforce component in particular. It is by far the biggest component of the agency, both in terms of headcount, but also budget, and is largely federally funded. Although Minnesota, as you'll find out, has uniquely put more state resources into workforce than most states. We're a state that believes that talent has been part of our secret sauce, and so far more than our neighboring states and others, we've invested in workforce, but boy, we have a lot more work to do. We face today the tightest labor market in the entire country. There are 4 jobs open for every person searching for one. Every one of you know these details, and you hear them from your constituents and your business owners and your job seekers every day. It is a really unique dynamic that we face, and a huge opportunity for this committee to rethink how we do workforce development and the scale at which we address these issues, which I think, as a few of the members were discussing earlier with Dr. Corey, cover every aspect of every other committee that's going to come together. Workforce is that unifying issue that is just so relevant to all the other work that we do. So the task is big, the opportunity is great, and we're here to work alongside you. That's our agency's job. And so I'll walk a little bit of how we're structured. I'll turn to my colleagues to get into some of the programmatic details. But really, we want to make this an open conversation. So if at any time you want to just interrupt us, stop us, ask a question, great. And of course, we'll leave time at the end for a more free-flowing conversation. So with that, I'll dive into our deck. Here we go. You know, we are a mission-driven agency, and our mission is really simple. It's to empower the growth of the Minnesota economy for everyone. This is a picture of our mission up on our wall. It's taller than even I am. It's the first thing you see when you get out the elevators. We're reminding ourselves and our agency every day both what it is we're here to do and the values through which we do them. This is a refreshed mission and values under our leadership since the governor came into office. We're in a new headquarters building at the Great Northern Building in downtown St. Paul. We're doing ribbon cutting in the next month or two. We'd love to have you all there if you can make it. We've had kind of a new energizing moment at the agency to bring ourselves together at a really unique moment in our economy. And we can talk more about our culture in the coming weeks and months ahead. But I think just quickly at a glance, again, unique thing about DEED covers both workforce and economic development. Unique advantage. Both sides of that kind of supply and demand for labor equation doesn't match up perfectly all the time, but it matches up quite a bit. At a very basic level, of course, we're here to create jobs that are great for Minnesotans and to help workers connect not only with a job, but a good job, a high-paying job that allows those workers to live independently. And, of course, as you'll find out, we are asked to and eager to focus on those that face the biggest barriers to find employment. That is the job of government, to focus on those areas where we face the most challenges. Our design is really broad in spectrum. So if you think about every experience that a worker could have in their given day, whether it's, you know, having to go on unemployment insurance or looking for a new job or managing a disability in the workplace, we cover that full spectrum. It makes the agency very functionally diverse, the most functionally diverse agency of its kind in the entire country. That means we apply everything from employment and training for individuals to unemployment insurance to business recruitment to our trade office to broadband development to community development. It is a really broad look at every experience that either a worker or business could tackle. And of course, today we'll focus on the worker component of that more specifically. We run the agency in a transparent and goal-driven way, and this is something that we brought into Deed because we felt that the public and our people deserve to know where we're going and how we're going to get there. So we use a very basic methodology called objectives and key results. We set big, ambitious goals that are qualitative, they're meaningful, they're inspiring, they reflect the governor's vision and the statutes and guidance that you give us as our board of directors, if you will. And then we ask ourselves, what are our key results? What does success actually look like when we tackle those objectives? These are measurable things. We track them every quarter. We don't want to leave anything to chance. If we achieve these key results, metrics driven, we know we'll have landed on our objective. It's aspirational. We score it every quarter. These are stretch goals. We don't always succeed. If we set goals where we succeed at all the time, we're just sandbagging it, right? So we are very much in a position of how do we stretch ourselves to do new things administratively within the guidance that you give us to create a better agency and a better state. As you think about kind of where we're headed as an agency, you know, we're all going to figure that out together this session, right? Because you're going to work with us and tell us and engage with us on how we should evolve the department. And I also want to highlight this very unique report that we pulled together that guides kind of how we run the place as well. And it's called the Governor's Council on Economic Expansion. Many of you may have heard about it, you may have read about it. It is a unique council of 15 leaders from labor, business, philanthropy, nonprofits that the governor brought together about 2 years ago to build a roadmap for our economy. We felt coming out of COVID, my land, everything's changed. Everything's disrupted. Nothing's the same as it used to be. And if we don't have a plan that's thinking long-term, then what are we doing in government? I mean, that's our job, right? And so we put together with this group after several months, a 10-year roadmap for where our state needs to go. And it is remarkably practical while also being really visionary. And I think the biggest point that this plan makes, and I know you all feel because of where we're at and why you're sitting here, is that Minnesota stands at an absolute inflection point in our history. Inflection points are truly rare, but this is one of them, right? You've got some of the biggest disparities we've ever faced. You've got the whole world looking at us in the wake of George Floyd's murder. You've got an $18 billion surplus that you can use to make change. And you've got a COVID-19 pandemic that has shifted so much of where innovation's happening, how disruption's moving. You've got rapid technological change that we need to keep up with, and some severe demographic headwinds. So all those things looked at are either challenges or opportunities, but they all equal to us that this is an inflection point. What we do together with you over the next few weeks and months, come the end of May, is going to affect decades of Minnesota prosperity. You all know this. It's why you ran. It's why you're here. So this plan takes that as its assumption and takes equity as its central animating focus in its roadmap. And the five commitments you see here, we could do a whole other session on this, but I just want to mention it briefly here, is to commit to our people, our communities, our businesses, commit to innovation, and commit to our infrastructure development as the key kind of programmatic pillars of growing an economy over the next 10 years. This report, it is the most readable government report you'll ever set your eyes on, is extremely practical, about 25 pages of here are the very specific and big picture things we need to do to make good on these commitments. And I think I just wanted to share it here because it's really kind of how we're driving our work forward, how the governor's budget has come together, which you'll learn more about very soon. So with that, I'm going to just get into the org structure. I want you to know kind of how we're organized in workforce. Broadly at Deed, we have four major departments. We have workforce development, workforce services, economic development, and general support services. That's just kind of how we run the place. Economic development, of course, with Chair Hassan and her committee. Today, we're going to walk workforce development and workforce services, two different collections of divisions within the agency. We're going to get into the specifics of what those divisions do. And then excited to take your questions. So we're going to start with workforce development. And for that, I'll turn to my colleague, Deputy Commissioner Mark Majors, who leads this department. So Mark, over to you.
Deputy Commissioner, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Sure. Good morning. Excuse me. Mark Majors, Deputy Commissioner of Workforce Development at Deed. That's a pleasure to be here with you all today. And thank you, Commissioner Crowe, for the introduction. A little bit of background about myself is that I'm actually originally from Minnesota. But my family, and my family packed up and moved to Boston and also to New York City, where I spent my formative years. Then I went out to San Francisco, though I did not know the commissioner there. I got my degree from the University of San Francisco, and then went back to New York because I guess I was tired of the sun. Actually ended up working for the New York City Department of Employment for about 7 years. Also obtained my master's degree from NYU And then I didn't think that that was enough education, so I went to Vermont Law School thereafter. And ask me if I'm using any of that of the education, I'll tell you, maybe. I'm still paying back loans, though. So I took that apprenticeship program that was talked about earlier. After that, I went back to San Francisco and worked for the Mayor's Office of Economic and Workforce Development there, where I oversaw what was called the WIA programs at that time, as well as a leading construction pre-apprenticeship program. And then I think I got tired of going back and forth, and I decided to stop home here in Minnesota, and I came back about 4 years ago, where I came in as the Deputy Director for Employment and Training Programs, and then just recently, according to LinkedIn, I've been in the Deputy Commissioner role for about 11 months now. So I'm glad to be home. I am a lifelong Viking fan, Twins fan, and all the others. Yes, I wear my heart on my sleeve, especially this week with our sports team. But I'll say my first work experience actually was in Minnesota, where I worked for a minority-owned business, construction business. It was there where I did a lot of work, kind of laborer's work, if you will, as a younger person. And I realized that I should not be around heavy machinery. It was not something I knew my work would have to be behind a desk. So I'm close and dear. Workforce is very important to me, and I'm really glad to be here with you today. So as the division of the Workforce Development Division, our work is to ensure that businesses have the talent they need to be locally and globally competitive, and that workers have the skills and opportunities that they need to be meaningful and have a family-sustainable employment and wage. DEED delivers many of these services directly to Minnesota via our Career Force Centers, which you may know as Workforce Centers, or if you're on the federal, if you understand the federal tracking, American Job Centers. We have approximately 55 of them across the state, and as well as we also have digital services, and we're also finding other ways to provide virtual assistance. And that's actually, as a result of COVID, we had to be really kind of innovative and transformative in the delivery of our services. We also prioritize our partnerships with our local workforce development areas, so not-for-profits, unions, colleges, universities, and adult basic education programs. And then we have our first division is our employment and training division, which I mentioned earlier, I was the deputy director of. We have that division has oversight of the state's federal WIOA program, or the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act funding, which is actually comes down from the Department of Labor. And the particular programs we have oversight in that program are what we call Title I, which is youth, adult, and dislocated worker, and senior program, as well as some of our demonstration programs that we've had, in which include opioid, COVID, and retain. In addition, basically what we do is we identify the skill needs of our recipients, provide training, address barriers to employment, and then try to match them to the jobs that are vacant out there. ETP also oversees the state's workforce fund as well. And that includes funding programs like Pathways to Prosperity, Work Women's Economic Security Act, Southeast Asian grants, immigrants, African immigrant grants, and delivering of services to a variety of programs. Now, in the case, and I'll take a step back, in the case of the federal funds, those programs are delivered by what we call local workforce development areas, and that's required by law. It's $4 million that comes to DEED, and then they pass down to our local development areas. In the case of our state funds, and thank you to the legislature for those funds, those actually kind of go down either to our local workforce development areas, community-based organizations, our colleges, our unions, and other stakeholders throughout the state. I mentioned a couple of our programs for our adult programs, but I got to make sure I mention our Youth at Work, our Minnesota Youth Programs, as well as our youth Build Programs are also our signature programs for ETP. And then just last, in the last biennium session, we actually were fortunate enough to get funding what we call the Internationally Training Professionals grants, as well as getting to work. Thank you, Commissioner. Okay, our Career Force Center, I kind of talked about that. So we have about 55 of them across the state. And really what their purpose is to work with career seekers to develop and improve job readiness for in-demand occupations that pay family-sustainable wages. We also offer veteran services for those veterans coming back home who need assistance with entering the workforce. We also partner and collaborate, engage with employers to find and train their workers. We do a lot of communications with programs and services via innovative. I talked about this innovative and mobile-friendly websites like CareerForce and MN. We provide online resume and job matching systems for employers and job seekers through our Minnesota Works, and that's actually required by federal law through our Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act. I'm sorry, I'm trying not to use the acronyms that we're so good at doing here. But I got to say that our Work Career Force system has done a great job, an amazing job over the last couple of years. You know, with the closing of COVID and the need for workers that the commissioner talked about, we really expanded our services. And we expanded actually kind of going out to community-based organizations, creating linkages, delivering services to them, as well as we also expanded our services and working with some of our libraries across the state. That allowed for more opportunities for us to get into those communities that have been traditionally overlooked or not accessible, to be quite frankly, our services are not accessible to them. I think there's some number, so don't quote me on this, but approximately about 300 connections over the last 2 years. So we're really proud of those efforts and we'll continue to do so. Another thing that we've done over the last few years is actually been reaching out to our folks that are coming home through our reentry program. We've had a contract through MnDOT previously where we actually trained individuals to enter into some of our apprenticeship programs like the cement masons. And then just recently, we were very fortunate to obtain a grant from the federal government to work with our Minnesota folks who are in our federal prisons. And so we'll continue to develop those reentry services through those grants. And then so we talked about you heard a little bit of what's called the Governor's Workforce Development Board. So this is a mandated board that's required by the Department of Labor. And basically it's a board that's composed of individuals from the private sector, labor, some of our educational institutions, some members on the legislature, and community-based organizations. And to help us to kind of look at what workforce would look like for the state of Minnesota. It's really more of a policy board and a guidance that helps us with really understanding what the next career pathways are and opportunities are for Minnesotans to enter the workforce and help meet the need for that employers have. Moving forward, we're really excited, and Commissioner has announced this, but we're going to transform that board a little bit. While we have the largest board in the country, I'll say it one more time, the largest workforce board in the country, we want to put our partners who are working with us to work. And so we've identified, we're looking at industry sector committees, looking at focusing on equity, focusing on disabilities, youth, and also the future of work. Because again, we want to know what are the future jobs coming to Minnesota, and we want to be prepared for that. And we're going to do that work, working with all those members from the private sector, government, unions, as well as our educational systems. And then our Office of New Americans. I am so excited about this office because not at any more time in our state's history do we need to have our new Americans get them into our workforce. And as you know, Minnesota is home to almost 500,000 immigrant and refugee residents here. And there's a need to help skill those folks up and get them into the workforce and then so that they could have viable careers and to create businesses and also to help improve our local economy. And just to make us competitive as a state, we have a lot of folks that come here, it's a very diverse group of folks that come here that have a lot of great skills. And sometimes we need to, and they just need a little bit of help to actually get them skilled up so that they can enter the workforce. So as a lot of you may know, we got to the finish line last session of Office of New Americans, and I'm really hoping that we get this across the finish line this year because there's just a great deal of work that's needed in order to move our economy forward. And I know our immigrant and refugee affairs communities can help us do that.
Great. Well, thank you, Mark. And we'll bring Evan up here, too. And as they switch seats, I'll just share kind of a broad view of this, which is that first group employment training programs is essentially how we put money into nonprofits in your communities to do training. That's kind of our partnership strategy. Those 300 connections Mark talked about is our partnership touch points. Career Force is how we do the work ourselves. And that has shifted almost entirely to digital, although we still do have some in-person work. But we know that people find jobs in different ways today. And then the Governor's Workforce Development Board is essentially our board of how we do the work and how we plan, both business and labor. And this office that Mark and team are building on New Americans is so exciting. It's something we're going to be pitching to you all to substantiate. It's run by a grant now, as Mark mentions. And and we think we can make it an always-on thing, and there's a lot more to talk about there. But just grateful for Mark's leadership and what he's done, both revamping that grant program to make it so successful and looking at this holistic picture to build a stronger division. And with that, ad lib to give you a chance to switch seats. I will now switch over to Evan to take on Workforce Services, a really important division of our company, which is going to be very recognizable, or of our agency that's going to be very recognizable to many of you.
Thank you, Commissioner. We do have a question from Chair Becca Fenn.
Oh, sure.
Thank you, Chair. Just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how these services, you know, you talked about nonprofits, but I know, you know, as we were just talking about earlier, the connection with what our high schools are doing, you know, like the high school in my community has a culinary program, an automotive program, a construction program, you know, how do you interact and how does that overlap with sort of the education sphere and not just nonprofits?
Yeah.
Commissioner.
Chair Zhang, President Becker-Finn, it's a great question. And I will say this, we have programs at the agency that focus on youth, but not enough. And you bring up an important insight here that a career journey does not start at age 18. It starts earlier. And the impressions and beliefs that high schoolers have when they're in those really formative years about what a good career looks like and how they can prepare for them are essential. And I think we are concerned that Minnesota has the lowest proportion of guidance counselor to student ratio of any state in the country. And we know we have some good grant programs and initiatives helping youth through such things as youth at work, youth build. We work with MDE on CTE programs to get businesses connected into those high schools, but they're simply not enough. And there is a broader narrative and perception, and I think it was mentioned a little bit earlier by one of the members, if I recall, that if you don't have a four-year degree, you're not up to snuff. And I think for 30 years in this state and in this country, we delivered a message that it's either college or nothing else. Yep. And that has shifted people's perceptions because we thought also that all these manufacturing jobs were going to China. Manufacturing is a $50 billion plus industry a year in Minnesota. It's our second largest industry after healthcare. So surprise, all those jobs didn't go away, and they can't go away. And you look where the federal government's headed now, they're actually trying to invest more in manufacturing jobs here. So young people and our work with young people is essential. We've got some apprenticeship programs. We've got some funding for CTE. We've got some of these high school internship programs like Step Up and others that many of you support and know well that we support through some of our grant dollars. There's about 25 of those through our youth program that we support across the state, but it is not enough. It is a single-digit percentage of our workforce development dollars, and I know something Mark is as passionate about as I am, and you can probably hear it in my voice as someone who has a nonprofit that focuses on this too. We've got to start earlier. We've got to invest earlier if we're going to have a state that prepares our workers. So I'm glad you raised it.
Sure, Becca.
I follow up. You know, and I think, you know, the goal, I think, should be when a young person leaves high school, you know, they either have, you know, college credits from AP courses or PSEO or the training to set them up to be successful. You know, like we even have a drone program at Roseville,
cool.
You know, which is a very lucrative field if you know what you're doing. You know, they do 3D printing, screen printing, all those kinds of things. And I think it also speaks to if we want folks to thrive, it would be great to actually find the thing that's the passion for these young people so that it isn't just like, oh, you're an adult, now life sucks. You know, they actually have the skills to do things that are like rewarding to them as a person. You know, for some folks, it's going to be making things with your hands and doing that kind of work. And for other folks, it is going to be sitting at a desk. But I thank you for those comments because I think, you know, tying that together with the lack of counselors in our schools is something we should all keep top of mind. So thank you.
Representative Lesnicker.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioners. My question is just to the point of the representative. I loved what you were talking about with culinary programs and the trades and being able to build the houses on the property. I grew up with that too. I'm in northern Minnesota, and my concern is the way we fund schools in the state. The kids in northern Minnesota aren't having these opportunities, and so northern Minnesota needs to be able to do manufacturing and be set up for the mines and everything else. And we have resources that are there, and we have the trades there, and we need to partner these children so they're not disenfranchised. And so I think that the opportunities for all children in our state have to be looked at. We all use this entire state, you know. And if we visit northern Minnesota and the North Shore, we need to have employees. on the North Shore, or there is nobody to take care of the trails and Lake Superior and all the things we love to do. I love to do it too, but we need to allow these children to have a pathway to live in the communities they love too. Some of them want to be here, and we're all going to pick different places by our choices and our personalities and where our families live and all these variables. But when we look at education, we got to look at a method that funds for opportunities for all children. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zalesnikar, and that's what we're here to do. Chair Becca Finn.
Thank you. I realize I don't know all of you on the other side, but for the record, I'm a northern Minnesota girl, grew up in the Cass Lake area, so rural folks are always top of mind for me as well. I graduated with 36 people, Cass Lake being a public school, so definitely hear you in making sure that all our students are supported.
Thank you, Chair Becca Finn. Next, we have Deputy Commissioner Evan Rowe. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Zhang. Representatives, my name is Evan Rowe. I'm a Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services and Operations. And just by way of introduction, so born and raised in Minneapolis, but I actually spent a lot of time in Rep. Zalesnikar's district. My mom's family's all from Duluth, and I spent a lot of time in Hermantown, just on the Hermantown side of Haines Road. When I was growing up, went to Minneapolis Public Schools, went to Carleton College for undergrad, then spent about 5 years at Google, different team. I didn't actually really know the commissioner when I was there, but we got in touch over the years. Got a master's at Harvard after that, and then I spent the last 5 years working at the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority. So Boston Public Transit Agency, working on a variety of kind of commercial projects, operational items. I know way too much about parking lots and snow clearance, which has been very helpful. When I came back to Minnesota in 2020 to start within the kind of operations role at BEAD, and have also since June have been working on the workforce services area, which is what we're here to talk about today. There's really four pieces of what we call workforce services here at BEAD. There's vocational rehabilitation services, state services for the blind, unemployment insurance, and disability determination services. And just give a quick capsule of each of those. So VRS, vocational rehabilitation services, provides employment-related services for approximately 20,000 Minnesotans with disabilities each year who seek competitive, integrated employment. So, you know, with that, you know, disabilities is a broad spectrum. I think a lot of people, there's kind of a view that it's primarily physical disabilities, but VRS serves people with physical and mental disabilities throughout the full spectrum. And it really provides individualized service and individualized attention for folks who are trying to enter the workforce. I think one piece that's really worth mentioning is the pre-employment transition services also that VRS provides. So we work within the schools to help students with disabilities prepare for the workforce. Whatever that means, it can be a broad spectrum of emphases and where folks are going to end up. And VRS is also there to help Minnesotans with disabilities live independently and get their basic rights, such as housing, transportation, economic, and employment. These are complex, these are complex challenges. We do a lot of coordination with our partners at the Department of Human Services. We're working with counties. We're working with the folks in the career force. Every person is unique, and we really try, and the team works really hard to try to make sure that we're enabling the best in each Minnesota. Next is state services for blind. Minnesota has one of the strongest programs to support blind individuals in the workforce in the country. And really what this team does is they work directly with Minnesotans who are blind, deafblind, losing vision, or if they have a disability that makes it difficult to read. Right? And again, this can be a broad spectrum of services, but it's tools and training for employment, for living independently, and accessing. Right? So this can be anything from kind of helping an individual adjust to blindness if they're losing sight. It's providing tools and technology like screen magnifiers, app-based tools to help them be able to read printed materials. We have a Brailing Center where we can take printed materials and turn them into Braille so blind individuals can read it. And we also have a senior services unit that works with people who are losing vision but maybe want to stay in the workforce or who are adjusting to reduce vision, to help them live independent, healthy lives. And really, it comes down to living, working, reading, and succeeding. It's a nice little pithy statement of what the team does.
It's some of the most inspiring work that we do, and many states have copied and leveraged the resources that your team built.
I think it's not hyperbole to say that Minnesota has one of the strongest programs for blind individuals in the country. And again, it's a critical part of a workforce strategy. If we can provide tools and technologies and the capabilities, it's an incredibly strong workforce that we want to help. Unemployment insurance. So basically, UI essentially pays eligible workers up to 50% of their average wage, subject to a state maximum of about $850 per week for up to 26 weeks. So the idea is it's for people who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own to help them gain access to a replacement wage so that they can search for new employment and have basic needs met. We work really closely with the Career Force unit to ensure that workers have the assistance that they need to quickly return to employment, helping with job searches, helping with putting together a career search plan. The pandemic was an unprecedented event for many things in the state, but especially for unemployment insurance, since much of the federal aid ran through the UI program. In a typical year, in 2019, the last pre-pandemic year, we paid about $800 million in unemployment benefits. During the pandemic, we paid about $15 billion to 875,000 Minnesotans. So it was a critical lifeline for Minnesotans to have the resources that they need as well in the wake of one of the most unprecedented events in national history. And I'll just note, Minnesota UI regularly ranks within the top five states in the country in achieving our federal performance standards. It's an efficient program, it's a well-run program, and it's one that, for a critical lifeline for Minnesotans, we take that responsibility really seriously. Then the last unit I'll just mention is the Disability Determination Services Unit. So this serves Minnesota residents who are applying for Social Security disability benefits and the Minnesotans who are reviewed for continuing eligibility. It's a program that we run in partnership with the Social Security Administration. They have sort of a distributed state model for reviewing disability claims. So essentially they refer the disability applications for individuals who may benefit from rehabilitation services and other agencies as well. So about 42,000 claims in 2021. This is 100% funded by the Social Security Administration. There are zero state dollars that go into DDS, but PEDA is the home for that program, and it provides really critical service, making sure that people have timely reviews of their disability applications.
Well, thank you, Evan and Mark, and we'll turn to your questions. I just want to end on a note of collaboration with you all. We are excited about the session ahead. We think it's the most important one in our lifetimes, and I know you all do too. Here's our commitment to you. We want to collaborate with you to grow our economy. We want to bring a yes and orientation to our work. You'll see that as we discuss your ideas and ours. We will center equity in everything we do. Hopefully that came through in our presentation, and we can go into far more detail there as we go forward. We're going to be honest with you, we're going to be transparent, and we're going to do the best we can to achieve our mission. We are not a perfect agency. We have lots of areas for growth and improvement. We want your help on that front, but we are excited, and we have a team in place that is really eager to be your partners in the months ahead. So I think with that, Chair, I'll turn it back to you, and happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Lee Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and gentlemen, good morning. It's a bunch of Minnesota guys, myself, too. It's welcome to see everybody here to really try to do some collaboration, and I have two questions, maybe one for Mr. Rowe right away. Unemployment question, it's simple, I think, but I'm having a hard time getting a question answered. H-2A visas are a big deal in rural Minnesota. Legal folks here helping us with our farms, with our construction jobs. Our employers are paying unemployment insurance benefits to that insurance fund. But these employees cannot draw on that. Can you help me understand why employers are asking me the question about why can't we, why do we pay a benefit to something that our employees can't get a benefit from? If you can help me with that, and then I've got one follow up.
Deputy Commissioner.
Sure, John Lee Baker. I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I think, generally speaking, the answer to these questions tends to reside in Federal Department of Labor guidance, but that's certainly one that I'd be happy to track down and try to get a clear answer for you on, because you know, I understand where that question
comes from. Yeah, thank you. It's what I've been getting every time I ask that question, and nobody can seem to ask it. So we'll find a way to fix that. And to Commissioner Grove's comment, we want to collaborate in a way to fix that problem if that's an issue that we can try to fix. If it's not something that's encumbered on the federal level, let's find out why that is happening, why businesses are paying such a thing that if our employees can't get that benefit, if they're not able to enjoy that. And I think this is just more of a kind of an opening statement, too, for our work ahead of us, Chair, is that we've got a lot of things coming at us this year. I know, you know, again, Commissioner Grove, you and I worked on a lot of things in the past. We worked on the COVID relief emergency funds with businesses, and they were very complex discussions, and they were in a very fast manner. And I know your commitment to the workers is very intense. What we are facing right now, though, I feel is folks in the minority and person in business myself. If new members don't know me as well, I'm a small business guy. We run a couple hotels out in western Minnesota, have a small cruise line business that does party cruises and things like that for family reunions and things. So we have about 40 employees that work for us, and our business is unique. It's a seasonal business. It's a small potatoes, mom and pop kind of a thing. But what we're facing coming at us this year is a steamroller with some very large, thank you for nodding your head, I know you know this is coming, and it's troubling for a small business like mine that is worried that a one-size-fits-all with paid family leave and sick and safe bills coming, they're troubling from a standpoint that those are not benefits we don't think are important. We do. But our business sizes matter. And I want to make sure that when we talk about this, that you are listening to business, that you're listening to us, because we want to give the most we can to our employees that work so hard. And we have done so much transformable stuff in the last couple of years to give our employees the best work environment that we can at the best pay we can possibly give, without hopefully pushing people away because we've had to raise our prices too much in our field of trying to get people to come and enjoy our services. So I do believe, though, that the governor's office, through Deed and others, businesses want to feel heard. We really want that relationship to get better with the governor's office. We want to grow that. We want to make sure that there really is a two-way street of hearing that. So I hope as we move forward this year with this committee and the work in front of us, and the challenges that we'll be facing, my business, very much different from a manufacturing plant where I've got about 20 housekeepers that work for me. If a housekeeper who typically works from 9 to 2, I have both men and women that fill that role, but it's very flexible for them. A lot of times will get their children on the bus, they come to work for me, they're home at 2 o'clock, they're home for the kids, and that benefit has also got to be wavered and weighed somehow, because it's a benefit to them to be very flexible. If they call in sick and we're shorthanded, we get to put a couple rooms out of order for the night and we get to clean them the next day. But on a manufacturing line, you can't let certain line be empty. You just can't run the line. But you can do things different in different businesses. So I just ask all of us here this year, this whole season, to be mindful of that, to be mindful that businesses are not all the same and one size does not fit all. So I extend that offer. I want to make sure that our relationships matter, that our voices are all heard, because I know you're excited for this session for maybe different reasons than I am. Everybody has their tone of what's coming. I'm just concerned that businesses in Minnesota are going to look at a different ratio in 5 or 10 years, and right now we are at a crisis. We have 4 open positions for one person looking. It's going to get better when more businesses leave the state of Minnesota. And they're slowly kind of expanding outside of Minnesota. They are. There's some that we can note that there are some coming in. But those are the facts. And I don't want to see us go that way, because then the ratios get better, but then our economic engine doesn't get any bigger either. That's a problem, too. So I just wanted to say that, Chair, we look forward to collaborating, engaging, but I want to make sure that we don't really believe that it's just easy for businesses to just take on some of these things, and we want to make sure we do a better job with that. So that's all I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And again, gentlemen, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Lee Baker. I have two more members, and we're going to wrap it up. Representative Ryder, keep it short.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly will. In looking at the disability determination slide, just based on experiences of family and constituents, I was thinking about how that intersects with the VA and then more broadly, how the services you provide, how you're also accommodating the unique employment challenges that returning veterans may have. From workforce development to the full range of services, but from your perspective.
Yeah, Chair, Representative, it's a great question. I myself have a family member who took advantage of early Social Security. My father got eye cancer about 10 years ago, had to have an eye operation, lost his eye, got early Social Security from DDS, had a great experience with that, and it really helped him survive a very difficult moment for our family. So it's broken his home to me, too. It is an entirely federally funded program. Every single speck of it has come to the Social Security Administration. It is not connected to the VA directly from a funding source. But certainly there are connections in terms of veterans who have disabilities that put them out of work earlier, and they can access those benefits like any citizen. To your broader question on how DEED engages the veterans, it is a central component of our workforce development efforts. And we have an entire team, about 20 individuals at DEED, who are all veterans. That's a requirement to have this job. You have to be a veteran yourself, who run a group focused on helping veterans find jobs. And it is one of the best run, most effective, most synergistic units of workforce development we have in the agency. The legislature has been very thoughtful in giving us a roadmap on how to deliver on this. And it is focused really heavily on finding veterans the best jobs they can. They're based across the state, run by a great leader, our director, Ray Duha. We'd love to get more into that issue and how we navigate that work for the agency, but it's a critical part of our charter.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know that we have some more questions from members, but if you can follow up with the Commissioner and the Department after this, we are out of time. Staff is reminding that. So thank you, Commissioner Grove, Deputy Commissioners, for your time. I'm looking forward to your partnership as we tackle the many issues in our state.
Thanks,
that said, committee is adjourned.